Welcome back to Midweek Mysticism. Thank you for your patience. It's a pleasure to have everyone here. Maybe Rabbi Karpel will join us also. We are, as you may recall, on the heels of the teaching of the Kala, the night of the Kala, which we're going to come back to. So the Zohar hasn't dropped that thread, even though the teaching's over. It's going to emerge at the end of the next teaching, not this one, but the next one. And we were in a teaching that was fundamentally dealing with the following issue. Breshis, bar Elokim, mesa shemayim v'aretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Elohim, the plural word. And so the Zohar just attacks that word because it is very concerned with the immediate, you know, kind of realm of divinity. All the angels, all the holy forces, all the demons. Who's got power here and who's in charge? And so Chazal had their way of dealing with it, which is to say God needed to seek permission from the other divine beings in order to create, because God is humble. That's a moral teaching about leadership. But the Zohar is very much concerned, and specifically because for the Zohar, with divine emanation, God is ayin, is ein sof, is unknowable at the highest level. And so the whole theory of emanation versus plain, I don't know, lightning bolt creation is one of obscuring divinity enough that it might be seen and realized by people. That's the whole process. Right, or taking infinite divine and transposing it into a finite realm. And so once we're doing that, we're going to have lower divine beings. And so, Breshis Elokim, Esos Shamayim V'aretz, you know, like Elokim sounds good. The divine beings, the whole entity. You know, and so, but then we have this other idea, and they quoted from Yirmiyahu, that God's going to destroy these foreign gods. So they're really pitting the monotheistic ideal of the prophets against the mystical idea of a kind of unseen holy world of angels, and saying, which is it? Is it pure monotheism or is it mystical Kabbalah? They're kind of, I feel like they're putting it on the table. Okay, that's a contextual framing. And now to the demons, because the Zohar is interested in the details. We will be exploring a lot of lore today. This will be the Jewish equivalent of, you know, a venture into a Tolkien-like piece. Okay. I don't remember exactly where we left off, but I'm going to start with Va'arka Va'ara Mubayilai. Does that sound good? Arka, it should say Ara. It's a little, does that retrograde us too much, or is that okay? Ba'arka ve'ara mabayle, ela begin da'arka yachad d'meinun shvarin d'letata, hu atar eats b'ni b'noi d'kayin, levatar d'itavrach me'al p'nei ara, nachit d'tama v'abit toldot v'establish tama d'layada klum, So, in the Targum of the verse, it said the Arka for land, and they ask for Arka v'Ara mevayleh. Now, for us, the two that we'll need to know for this teaching, there are kind of seven levels of terrestrial earth. And by the way, all materiality is rooted in a kind of mixture with darkness, right? In other words, materiality or corporeality or finitude is fundamentally understood to be negative. Now, there is hidden light in it, in the Lorianic metaphor of that, right? There are shards of glass. People are familiar with the idea of Shfirat HaKelim, maybe this Lorianic idea that in the beginning, God gave a flow of light to create, but the vessels, the kelim, broke. Shvirata kelim, one of the great three Lurianic myths, I think. That of Tzimtzum, that of Shvirata kelim, and that of four or five worlds. Probably the big contributions of Luria to Kabbalah. So that's his metaphor for it. Everything that's physical is a shard of glass. Now, shards of glass cut you, just to be clear. I stepped on a shard of glass just yesterday. And then I had to use tweezers to extract it. Right? It's not pleasant. So his idea is, you know, the world is shards of glass. So that's a pretty negative view of the world constantly cutting you. And serving as a threat, but they are attached to light. In the Lurianic metaphor, you should know, there are 320 sparks of light, of which 288 are recoverable. We can discuss that some other time if we want. It's a very specific metaphor. But even maybe pre-Luria, and you'll see elements of this here, this notion that our world is Tevel, which we'll see at the end of the teaching. You know, in the Psalms are always talking about, for example, in Kabbalat Shabbat, Tevel being this place where justice will rule. So Tevel is the most holy of the terrestrial worlds, of the seven terrestrial. There are seven heavens and seven earths. And Tevel is the most elevated. And Arka is the third of the seven. And at different points, all seven will be referenced in the Zohar. But not in order, just here, Tevel and Arka. So, I guess it's just worth saying that as soon as we're talking about terrestrial worlds, the immediate place your mind should go is dark and light, mixture of dark and light, right? Because our world has moments of beauty and lots of moments of not beauty. And our, I'll add psychologically, our experience of the world is maybe majority fearful and negative, with moments of gratitude and appreciation, right? Like, in other words, the Zohar is colored by the human perception or the human negativity bias even, or human modes of cognition is reflective, Tzelem Elohim, in the image of God, of the way in which this world is. So if we are more drawn to, say, worry or negativity than beauty, that's not just an interesting coincidental feat of neuroscience. That's reflective of the makeup of the world we embody. Because we're kind of the archetype of the world in this anthropocentric view of it. Okay, Ba'arka and Earth, the verse should read Ba'ara. But Arka is one of these seven Earths below, we mentioned, site of the descendants of Cain. After he was banished from the face of the Earth, he descended there, generating offspring. He blundered there, knowing nothing. It is a dual earth, dualized by darkness and light, or evil and good. Okay. Now, a few things. It is Cain's descent to this world, which, by the way, is considered also to be the land of Nod. Right, that's where it is. Right in the Bible, this place Nod is where he's sent. He's a mitznat ned, a wanderer. And there's this idea that Cain, a descendant of Adam, is banished because of his evil action, right, killing Hevel, his brother. And so, goodness is constantly wandering here, and Cain's coming there means the human entry is a kind of a flow, as it were, into this land that causes offspring to be generated. And these offspring are, we'll see. Okay. One other thing, I guess it is worth saying, when Adam sins, people have asked about original sin before. The idea in the Zohar from many passages is very clearly that when Adam sinned, it brought the whole world, the whole universe into a state of materiality, that before that it wasn't material. So this sin is considered a kind of fall for all subsequent souls, And it's actually that sin which generates, in certain Kabbalistic traditions, the need for reincarnation. In other words, that is only because of the materiality of souls being trapped in a cycle of life and rebirth that Adam's sin necessitates. And that Eve will give birth in pain isn't just about giving birth in pain for Eve. It's about birth in pain for everyone who's born, suffering, you know, the Buddhist elements. Subsequently, Cain's sin descends all the souls that descend from Cain. And so every one of these original kind of figures, Cain being a direct descendant of Adam, are seen as sinning and bringing down, you know, the whole line of their descendants thereafter into a lower world.
Okay. It doesn't that also work in the opposite direction? Like, you know, if to be descended from David is to have, you know, a mark of glory in you, right? So like, the idea is your descendants always reflect something of your nature. And if it's an elevated nature, that's a plus. And if it's a depressed nature, literally and figuratively, then that's a minus.
Yes, right. This may have been a kind of spiritual, you know, genetic. Or yes.
Something like that, right. It's just essence. That's a good word for
essence,
that. But
yeah.
But just minor digression and just ignore it if you want to move forward. But just that Adam's sin created materiality. So what was the apple they were tempted with if it wasn't already a material apple?
Yeah. So like, in other words, the apple is described in very material terms. There are a lot of debates about that. The probably the classic take from the Zohar is that actually Eve, I realize Adam's sin here is really a stand-in for Adam and Eve's sin now.
Right.
Eve engaged in some kind of sexual act with the snake, whose venom mixed with that of Adam before the world was ready for them to procreate, i.e. before creation had been complete. And so before the full divine flow had emanated, they engaged in an act of Adam, Eve, and the snake engaged in some kind of sexual act. Now, you might ask, sexual sounds very physical, but at a higher level, some kind of procreative act as an attempt to carry something forward before taking the buns out before they were baked in the oven, so to speak. And as a result, there's like a spiritual genetic defect from this act. It could be that when we say that the snake deposited venom, they view the snake as this demonic, disembodied sexuality of Adam. I think this is part of the leading theory I'll go with, the one I like best, which is they understand the snake to be a phallic symbol representing not Adam, because it's disembodied from Adam in the story,
right?
But imagine that the snake was Adam's libido, as it were, and it was just so out of control that it's literally represented by an alternative character in the story,
right.
It seduces Eve. So, and then Eve seduces Adam. So here we have a very more nuanced story of sexual temptation that emerges, whereby Eve, allured by Adam's phallus, is then tempted, decides to tempt Adam, who's tempted by Eve. So Adam tempts Eve somewhat stupidly or unknowingly, and Eve returns. And so it could be that the fruit eaten is no fruit at all in this version of the story, but is just a big metaphor for a sexual innuendo.
Yeah.
That's, I think, what the
so is the banishment from the garden then representative of taking on a material form? Is that right? And obviously the punishments that go with that you now have to till the earth and you'll give birth in pain are very, you know, physically expressed. So all of this on this reading is occurring in some spiritual level until they're banished from the garden, at which point they take on physical forms.
Yeah, and the term for that the Kabbalists use is Adam Kadmon. Let's call it primordial or cosmic Adam.
Right.
And so it's really a story about the inevitable fall of kind of a cosmic pre-human incarnation into a fully human material state.
So then
Adam
the last
and Eve aren't really human in the story of the Garden of Eden,
right?
Kabbalistic thing. They're really divine manifestations, as evidenced by the fact that they're B'Tselem Elohim. So they understand that to mean they're not really human. They're kind of godly.
Yeah.
And so they sin.
Then last question, and please don't follow it if you want to move forward, but just usually you would think the sexual metaphors, which are now you're locating prior to the embodiment, they're what produces the embodiment. But the sexual images usually you would think go along with the physical embodiment, right? As pure spirits, that's when no sexuality is quite present there often. But I guess on the other hand, the whole thing. Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
So I'm fascinated that produces the embodiment when you would usually think sexuality is like the consequence of embodiment as opposed to the generator of embodiment.
Yeah. So welcome to the postmodern Kabbalistic theory of sexual attraction, which would say, I think, and this is the way they understand it, that pre-humans, there was also sexual energy. In fact, the real sexual energy is divine. Let's call this tantric Kabbalah today. And so they would say that the real sexual energy, as we know from their understanding of the Godhead, which has these male and feminine aspects to it,
right,
is about a certain creative energy or flow, and that attractions are caused often from the female to the male in their understanding of it, rising upward to create a flow downward. Kit'orut dilatata. We've seen awakening from below, I think, two times now. Meaning the female seduces the male, is that the female energy causes the male energy to come down. And they would even understand that Adam and Eve's sin was a play within the Godhead among certain divine forces for power to create. So in the same way that it was apparently true when we were taught in middle school that sex is as much about power as hormones or whatever they used to teach us more about that. So actually the Kabbalists might agree that that physical bodies are just another place for this kind of thing to play out, but they understand sexual energy to be pre-material.
Got it. Right. Thank you.
I have another related question, but maybe more closely related to just what we just read. So are we supposed to think of the relationship of these earths to one another? So Cain is banished and his descendants live in this other earth. Do they ever come back? Or are these entirely parallel material existences? How do they relate?
Yeah, there's a sense of thinking of it as the existing, if the upper worlds emanate into our worlds, then these are on the mirror image of wherever that is. So I don't know like what the spiritual multiverse theory is, the best way to say that is, but like there are certain divinities or divine energies manifest in this highest material world. And yet as you remove and cloak more of those divinities into yet a more shaded place, they exist here and now also. We're perceptive of the world of Tevel. But those other worlds exist just as the world of God exists, or Atzilut here. But those cause our energy. You know, our energy is a screening of that energy, whereas yet further screening of our energy causes these other worlds. So if you would think of upper worlds as being within but above our world, these would be within but below our world. So I don't know where to locate that. I'm like struggling for dimensions.
No. That's they can below, and it's sort of an emanation upward. If emanation can go upwards.
Yeah. So angels and demons will sometimes try and escape here. And actually, our story is going to be about how two particular angels fall into this world and become their overlords. So we'll get a story here. So that may help work with this a little. The itaman train memanan shalitin dishaltan daba kashoka bedaba nahora. The tama kichuga dabada. The word kitruga may become important. B'sharta denachit l'taman kayin, ishtata puda b'davi ishtalimu kechada, b'kol ha'chazit de'inun toldov de'kayin, v'alda inun b'train reishin k'train chayvan, bar de'chada hu nahura shalit natzach b'ilei v'natzach alachra, v'yada itkalilu divach ha'shochad b'nahura v'ahavuchad, inun train memanin afrira b'kas dimon, Vidyukna Dilahun Kidyukna Dilamalachin Kadishim Bashidgatvin, Khadyukna Kitura Vakadivna Kanishra, Vakad Makabranita Vidu Dyukna Da Adam. And now the promised demons. Where did I go? Two officials rule there, one ruling in darkness, the other light, inciting one another. When Cain descended there, they joined together, were completed as one, entirely befitting the offspring of Cain. So they have two heads, like two snakes, but the one of light rules, prevailing, defeating the other. So those two of darkness merged in those of light, and they became one. Those two officials are Afrira, named for Afar, for dirt, and Kastimon, traditionally understood to be named for like a Horban or like a prosecutor in Greek, though Matt has some other suggestions in the note, who resembles six-winged holy angels. One resembles an ox, the other an eagle, but when they join, they're transformed into the image of a human being. In darkness, they turn into the image of a two-headed serpent. I don't know if we got to this point yet. I think we stopped here. Okay. So, a few things.
I have a pshat question.
Yeah.
So he goes down, he generates offspring, but there's two officials there. And then it says, when Cain descended there, they joined together, completed as one. So is it the two officials that are joining together, or are Cain's offsprings joining together with these officials? Are these officials Cain's offspring?
Okay, so these officials...
Those are my questions, yeah.
Yeah, who are these officials? So we're going to see, and there are going to be two more later. These two officials are the fallen angels of Genesis. These are those fallen angels, the ones that seduce Benot Yisrael. You know, in Genesis, these angels come down, and these B'nai Elohim... and seduce, they try and seduce the daughters. These are them. This, of course, represents, you know, I remember at one point I was interested in this, and I asked the rabbi of our synagogue growing up, Rabbi Harvey Goldschedder, a fantastic rabbi. Rabbi Confort, did you know him? Okay, I thought maybe you knew him. Anyway, a wonderful rabbi of our local, and I asked him, are these things, because the note in my Chumash in the synagogue said, you know, that these are not fallen angels, the B'nai Elohim, you know, they're big people. And a lot of the Jewish tradition is to shy away from the idea that there are these fallen angels that sleep with women and produce offspring and that kind of thing. But the truth is, as we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls and other Apocrypha, that in the books of Enoch and other books of Enoch and the books of Jubilees and many other sources, that there was a robust tradition that these were in fact fallen angels, particular angels, who did to try and seduce. The thinking is, and one of them is male and one of them is female. And when Cain, when Cain goes down, his infusion of divine energy descending into this world causes these angels to have a kind of sexual union. So it's like that produces, when it means they're one, they're kind of like unified. And this unification means that I'm trying to think how to say this. Any unification is a positive force. And so when demons bind together, they lose their ego, right? Ego and power is the sense of disunity that causes the collapse into lower worlds. Think Cain and Hevel in the story. right? A kind of disunity of competition. But unity is the thing that raises up. And so when Cain comes down, even though he's descending, he's bringing kind of higher energy, which causes a kind of influx of more positive or creative energy into this world, which causes them to join as one. But sometimes darkness rules. Yes. And when darkness rules, they're like two snakes. And by the way, if we understand the snakes to be deceivers, egos, interested in tricking people like the snake in the story, like darkness is multiplicity and division and dissension and trickery, and light is unity. So sometimes they operate in two different states in this world, depending on whether this world has some unity to it or not. I don't know if I answered your question, the Pshat question, but basically...
You didn't. So they are not the offspring of Cain, and the offspring of Cain are not uniting with these angels. It's with these officials. The officials are separate from his offspring, and they unite with each other, but not with the offspring. That was my Pshat question.
Yeah, but it's kind of like they generate his offspring.
Okay.
You can kind of imagine that. So, like, he goes there and they unite, and their unity is a sexual unification which produces offspring. So they're kind of circling back. In other words, he had offspring. How did he have offspring? Sometimes they unite. Them uniting. You know, it's a little weird to say his offspring is the result of Afrira and Kastimon uniting.
Got it. Okay. Sort of got it.
Can I ask a sort of a maybe related question? But I guess in terms of this like alternate universe, this alternate reality, is the idea that like there's no homavdil between light and dark? Like everything, like seems like everything's all mixed together. You have animals that kind of are mixed together. Things have two heads. Like the critical one critical word in creation is homavdil, and is the idea that this world doesn't have that.
So this world is a slightly darker version of our world, but which sheds some light on aspects of our world. So Peter's question about where is this world in relation to our world, which is that in this world, light and dark are all mixed together. In this world, Arca, it's even more light and dark mixed together, right? Our world is pretty light compared to this world. The defining feature of this world, by the way, is that things don't grow there. If you want to know what happens in this world, you can't farm it. Nothing grows. That's the world of Arca, where things don't grow. It's a dystopia. And and so things are even more mixed than in our world. Perhaps the slogan would be Ein tzaddik ba'aretz asher ya'aseh tov v'lo yachta. As it says in the proverb, there's no righteous person in the world that does good and doesn't sin. And some of the Kabbalists understand that to mean every act of righteousness is also in part sinful. Not just there are some righteous and some sinful actions, but each act is inherently mixed. So that's the Lurianic teaching of the shards and the sparks, that there are shards and the light adheres to the glass shards. And you have to separate them. So here it's inseparable. It's nearly inseparable. It's a world where good is not able to be extracted from darkness. Sometimes good is in charge, but darkness is still there. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Silence, my... Now, six-winged holy angels. You should know there's a tradition in Kabbalah that the... the Vav of Yud Hey Vav Hey, which is the numerology of six, which also stands for the six Sfirot of Chesed Gevur Tiferet Netzach Hod Yesod, is why certain angels have six wings. And that the angels with six wings are fundamentally the messengers of Chesed Gevur Tiferet Netzach Hod Yesod. Their six wings represents that. But there are also angels of four wings. And those angels are represented by Dalit, and they represent the Shem Adonis of Dalit Nun Yud. Why that name? Because Dalit, as we've seen from the teaching of Rav Hamnuna Sava, as you may recall, standed for poor in a certain way, right? Dalit, and Shechina, the spherical chart, Malchut only receives, so it's poor. It doesn't have of its own to give. It's reliant on everything else above for flow. And so the four-winged angels are seen to live in Malchut, whereas the six-winged angels are seen to live here in this land, right? Containing energy from Bina, but all the way down here. The demons parallel these angels precisely, just that the flow from Bina is cut off in the technical understanding of it. So if a flow of Bina into this world produces angels that float through these worlds from heaven, Ma, to heaven, Mi, then the cutting off of this energy produces divinities without intelligence or without flow from the divine intelligence that struggle to have their own intelligence, which threaten, like Cain, to overthrow the enterprise. And so they mirror, they're the dark side. In Kabbalah, they're often described as the back of these things are where the demons are. Now, just to psychologize it, what does it mean to have, that's all jargony. What it means is that when you have these things without an intelligence ruling over them, it means to say that these things exist in total lack of harmony or in any kind of lack of planned relationship to each other. So the Kabbalah understands that it's not all about love or strength. It's about intelligently balancing them and picking spots, right? And trying to harmonize difference. And when you don't have any kind of intelligent plan for how that happens and everything runs amok, which actually feels like a decent description of 2021, maybe lots of good ideas or terrible ideas, depending on how you look at it, all running crazy over each other with no kind of context. No context is maybe the good for contextualizing. Then you get demons in back of these. So each of these has a backside, which is a demon. And there are six-winged demons, and there are four-winged demons. Okay. They resemble six-winged holy angels. Now, you may know from Ezekiel, that Ezekiel sees four angels with four faces that move in any direction. Yes, and they have the faces of a lion, and they have the face of a lion, an ox, an eagle, and a human in Ezekiel in his famous Merkava vision. So here, one is an ox and one is an eagle, which, by the way, represent the kind of back and left, kind of because they're demons, right? So they don't have the lion, which is the more forward-facing. And they don't have the human, which is like the integrated. They have the two more negative kind of understandings about it. The ox is the male, and the eagle is the female. You remember how we said they mate? So the Kabbalists understand that a free-reign costume, when we have ox and eagle, male and female. And the female, by the way, who's an eagle, goes and flies around at night and seduces men to do sinful things in their sleep. That's why she's an eagle. She flies from home to home. She's like the demon of Santa. When they are joined, they are transformed into the image of a human being. In darkness, they turn. It's okay. So they can join and they can redeem themselves a little, but in darkness, they turn into the image of a two-headed serpent. move, I don't know if we got here yet, moving like a serpent and swooping into the abyss, the Tahom, bathing in the vast ocean. Oh. Keep going. It's one of the things you benefit from continuing to go. All right, so Kad Inum bin, I didn't read it in Hebrew, we read it in English. Kad Inum bin Chashocha, Mitapchen the Diukna de Nachash between Ration, Vazlin Kachiva, Vitasin go to Homa, Vistachem be Yamaraba, Kad Matan the Shashla de Aza, the Azael. Margizin loan, Umitari loan. The Inum Medalgin go to Rechashocha, the Chashve de Kutsabriku, who buy the Mitbava Umdina. Ilan train Mimanin, Shatin Biyamirabo, Farchen, Mitaman, Ba'azlan, Bolele, Legabe. Naama, Imhon, Deshadin, Detawa, Vatra, Dachalin, Kadmain, Bachashin, the Mikrab, Legaba. Biu, Deliga, Chitin, Alpin, Parsin, Itavita, Bekama, Tsirin, Legabe, Bene Nasha, Begin, the Yitun, Bene Nasha, Vatra. Okay, so when they're doing their full demon, there are a two-headed serpent, moving like a serpent, swooping into the abyss, bathing in the vast ocean. The abyss, by the way, the Tahom, is the lowest of all worlds, based on the idea Tahom Rovetzet Tachat. The Tahom dwells below. Kabbalists love to take little quotes and make them principles. We have Tevel, we have Arka, we have Tahom at the other end. So before we had the vast ocean being Bina, you remember, or Yesod, or we had the vast ocean being the holy ocean. So now we have a demonic ocean, a negative ocean, as it were. They reach the chains of Uzzah and Azael. This brings us to our next two demonic figures who we'll meet today. Uzzah and Azael are two of the angels who are also referenced in plain Midrashic traditions that when God wanted to create, the angels objected. And they were jealous. People were going to sin. What kind of person are you going to make? There's a midrash. There's several versions of a midrash about it. And there's also a mystical midrash about it, which is explicit in a later section of the Zohar. There's one detailed section. Maybe we'll get there in volume 3, I think, where we'll get to it. But so lots of angels objected. Uzzah and Azael in the Kabbalah, what does Matt say about them? He may say something about their... These two angels opposed the creation of Adam and Eve, fell from heaven, and were attracted by the daughters of men. Okay, they were punished by being bound in chains in the iron mountain of darkness, from where they still managed to wreak havoc, teaching sorcery to humans. So, something a little more about that. There were many angels which objected. So it's not just that they objected. In the other passage of the Zohar, it says that Uzzah and Azael got punished because after God created Adam and Eve and they sinned, Uzzah and Azael came to God and said, "You see, you messed up. They sinned." And God put them away, changed them in these dark demonic mountains. The understanding of the Zohar there, but we could look at it if you want, is that they didn't believe in the power of teshuvah, of repentance or of return, that this material world could ultimately be elevated. That's part of the idea of teshuvah, not just that we repair our wrong deeds, but that the world which has been emanated can then also come back, right? Because once you're emanating and moving away from God, you also want to return to God. There's a kind of ebb and flow. So they didn't believe in that. They have a pessimistic vision. And so they are punished And they're mythologically teachers of witchcraft or dark magic, sorcery, in the mountains for those that reach them.
So there's like an in, there's somehow that that world is interacting with our world.
The dark mountains represent a place people can go in their mind with sorcery. For example, in Parshas Balak, the Zohar will say that the prophecy of Bilam is fundamentally a prophecy of secrets he learns from Uzan Azael. So it's this place of sorcery, of dark magic. Now, you may know that the sages say, and this will become important in the next teaching, which is the most, the Zohar gives all these things which are religious canonical truths of Judaism and rejects them all. It's a great teaching. It's the very next one. God is one. No, he's not. Moses is the best prophet. No, he's not. They quote that one too, which is also in the Talmud. Lo kam Yisrael kam Moshe od. There's no prophet in Israel like Moshe ever again, says the Torah. But in Israel, but not in Israel, Bilam, says even the Talmud in Brachot. Bilam was greater among the non-Jews. So the Zohar understands that he was so great because of his willingness to play with dark magic that righteous prophets were unwilling to venture into. It takes on a Harry Potter-like theme here, I think, where, you know, Voldemort has this deep evil power, which we don't know. But it at the heart of it represents a question, a deep question, which is evil more powerful than good?
Just a clarifying question on that. Is Azazel also the one that's not necessarily clarifying is I use loosely.
Is Azazel Azazel? There are mixed views on that.
Okay.
The Irla Azazel. Yeah. For you know the goat, the scapegoat goes to Azazel and Kippur. It's clearly the name of a wilderness region. Question is Azazel that? And some Christian Kabbalists, I believe, think that Jesus may have had an encounter here. I don't know. There are lots of overlaps. That's debatable, but certainly some claim that. Okay. Now, those two officials swim the vast ocean and fly through the night to Na'ama, the mother of demons, after whom the primordial deities strayed. So she is this... Now, who is she? She's actually the sister of Tuval Kayan, who's the granddaughter... great-granddaughter, Cain. She's a descendant of Cain in actuality, but she's understood to have this, you know, descendants of Cain, like we said before, you know, you come from a bad stock. So she's understood to be the incarnation of the mother of all demons. So she's the equivalent of Bina. She's the demonic equivalent of Bina. If you're trying to understand it right, if Bina is the aim, the mother of everything that exists in the spiritual realm, Na'ama is the demon mother. And they all stray after her, just like everything comes and goes from Bina. But also in the Pshat, they're sexually tempted by this woman, Na'ama. And by the way, whether they're male or female, they're sexually tempted by her. So the Zohar has this very kind of interesting thing going on. Okay.
Primordial deities are the same thing as the demons and the fallen angels, or are they related to other false gods, or what are they?
Yeah, they're the angels and demons. The angels that might become demons if they get tempted by her. You know, she gives both give birth to them, but she also causes otherwise well-meaning angels to fall into demonhood through her seduction and temptation. And she is the mother of one second. Okay. She's the mother of a famous Neiman, I think. It says it here. Yes.
Yeah, it says Matt gives it. Yeah.
Okay. Nama is the mother of Ashmedai, king of the demons. And she generates demons by seducing men in their sleep, see Nachmanides, etc. So.
I'm sorry. I have a question.
Are
these seven earths below, are those further manifestations of the emanation process which produces our physical world as a whole? So it continues on, or is this a completely separate realm that's created some other way? And my question is relatively tied in with the question of whether darkness is a positive entity or merely the privation of light in these metaphors here, because we're talking about these mountains of darkness or oceans of darkness, etc. But if it's just the product of emanation is like pure light, right? Isn't it? So where does darkness come from? Where do these worlds come from? Are they things that God creates in this process, or are they some alternative entity?
Well, you know, they don't start happening until we start messing up. That's the first piece. So they are created by our sins, starting with Adam. So that is to say, God emanates or retracts enough to a place, a good framing, to give us at least, even if it's fake, a perceptible free will. And once we have perceptible free will, we, through our bad choices, can create darkness. So this is a little bit of a punt on the question of, does God create darkness? And the answer is, you create darkness, you people, through your sins. But because we are divine emanated energies in the image of God, that evil that we do takes on real tangibility and creates beings that emanate out of us. That's the sense of it, which is why they're going to be obsessed with masturbation in a moment and how this makes so many demons, because it's a misuse of the creative energy. But there's definitely a sense that because we are in the image of God and not separate from God, as the Zohar will say, leita tar panoimen, no place devoid of God. So then if we're funneling God, then we serve as the intermediary to create evil. We are the divine intermediary. We are the demon. We are the chief demon.
Yeah. Although the fallen angels, that's not our doing, right? They were the ones who opposed our creation in the first place. So wouldn't that be an earlier or initial source of the darkness?
Right. Although they only fall after they start yelling about our sins.
Ah, okay.
So it's like interesting. It's like our sins not only cause negativity, they even cause higher beings to have so much debate about what to do with us that it all starts falling apart at the board governance level up there.
Yeah.
Like some get kicked off the board. It's like, you know what, you'll go where they've made the dark worlds. I guess the answer is darkness is not just the absence of light. It is a very real place here. Okay. And maybe I'll read just one more. I don't know who Susan Shifra Halevi is, but she's entered my waiting room. So we'll just do one more. Let's pause there. I think that's a good pausing place. Next week, if Naomi has not given birth, we'll meet. And if she has, we won't. And if we do meet, which, I mean, I don't know what, well, I was going to say, I hope we meet. I hope everything just works. But if we meet, which I'll very much enjoy, we'll finish this teaching. We're like one paragraph away from the end of it. So we'll finish the teaching of demons. I will say the final piece. Next week, we're going to be interested in the tikkun again. And this comes after the teaching of the tikkun and the night of the kala, to say flip sides of a coin. This is the ultimate framing. Human beings, through their spiritual power and spiritual insights, can create tikkun, can create new upper worlds, as we described, that actually rectify and draw energy from this world upward to bring energy down, to unify worlds and create messianic futures that don't even exist. We can create non-existing spiritual possibility. And human beings also create demonic worlds, tangible darkness and sexual competition and power and with these cast of characters. I do think for those directors and fiction writers in the audience, that there's for sure a good movie or two waiting to be made of these characters. They're quite interesting. Na'ama and Uzza and Azael and these two-headed. And anyway, someone should do something with it. There's a lot of creative stuff a creative person would do. And with that, I thank you all for a little bit of a darker edition of mysticism.
Thank you. And Bisha'a Tova.
Yes.
Name. Thanks.
Tova. Yeah, good luck this week. Thank you.
Thank you to everything. All right. Bye.